This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 16th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 175th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we'll preview the Oscars by celebrating the nominees for the things that tend to remain unsung. Set design's fascinating and editing's the thing.
I just feel immense pride and joy when I see it, and if I get sick of scrutinising, oh, did we get that edit right, then I can just look at all the other wonderful things that are in any frame on Wes Anderson's films and take great pleasure from just watching those.
We'll also speak to the curator of a new show at London's Barbican, celebrating artists' collections of the weird, wonderful, beautiful and unusual.
We took a lot of cues from the ways in which artists live with and display their objects. So if their studios are messy and full of things all over the walls, we tried to replicate that.
And we'll take a trip to Oregon to profile the venue that's keeping its head while all others are losing theirs in a gentrification frenzy.
Those small rooms that you can get your foot in the door are the incubators for creativity and risk taking that helps you form into what you're going to become as an artist.
Plus, we'll tread the boards in Toronto, and keeping it Oscar tuned, we'll dig a live Midori House session from Ryan Bingham, who won an Academy Award for the songs from Crazy Heart. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. As we're going to be speaking to a few Oscar nominees in a couple of minutes, it seems only fitting to first hear from an Oscar-winning musician. In 2010, Ryan Bingham won an Academy Award for his track The Weary Kind, which features on down-and-out country musician flick Crazy Heart. The song was nominated for multiple awards, and that, alongside two critically acclaimed albums, catapulted Ryan into the limelight. Bingham is an Americana artist who grew up in Texas and has just released his fifth record, Fear and Saturday Night. On a recent trip to London, he came by Midori House to play us a few tracks. Here he is first with Broken Heart Tattoos.
You were unborn and yet to be scarred with tattoos. The blood in your arm, hell, it's good and it's warm and still free to choose. So take your sweet time and walk a straight line in two. But don't you be shy of your wilder side, be afraid to let loose. With broken heart tattoos, somewhere inside where it all lives and dies, I know there lies a heart unbroken in the dark where love still grows. So follow the roads that make you feel old and brand new. You remain kind, yet aware of the signs, you'll know just what to do. With broken heart tattoos. Your unspoken thoughts have yet to be bought a soul, but whispers of time will write down the lines, stories will be told. And as the wind blows, your life will unfold some truth. Remember that I shoot arrows through lies should you sing out of tune. With broken heart tattoos.
That was Ryan Bingham performing Broken Heart Tattoos, and we'll be chatting to him later on in the show. Here on Culture, we're going to preview the Oscars by looking at a couple of categories without which no film would be much of a film at all, but which tend to get overlooked when there are the radiant smiles and jaw-dropping frocks of the red carpet to contend with come Oscar night. We know what best actors do, we get the deal with directors, and very interesting it is too, but what of these professions that need a little more unravelling to reveal a greater and more fascinating truth about the movies? Using the handsome prism of the Grand Budapest Hotel, Wes Anderson's hotly tipped pseudo-historical caper concerning a legendary hotel concierge on the run from the fascists, and who knows the truth, we're going to look at film editing and set design. So here, first of all, is Barney Pilling, nominated for the Academy Award for editing on the Grand Budapest Hotel. What does he do all day?
As soon as the cameras start to roll on the set, the editor is usually in place, or at least the second day, because it takes a day to process the material that they shot on the first day. So I was flown out to Germany 2 days before filming began and received my first material the second day that they were filming. So reasonably early on, no pre-production usually for an editor, unless it's a really complex special effect film, which actually this one turned out to be.
We sort of maybe have the traditional view that editors, I mean, as you've just disproven, but the editors turn up and they get given a load of rushes or a load of sort of unedited stuff and bang it into a narrative with the director. How closely do you work with Wes Anderson to carve a narrative out? Or does he, for example, with this film, have a very clear idea of what comes first, second, third in a sequence?
Yeah, I mean, Wes is incredibly well prepared as a filmmaker, and that's evident when you see any of his films, really. They're meticulously planned out, and obviously he's involved in the writing of the stories and the screenplays quite heavily. And actually with Grand Budapest, I think it was the first film where he was solely responsible for the screenplay itself. And I think also the nature of what he does, inherent in his style and his rhythm and humour, are the complex and elaborate camera moves. So these obviously are very well planned out early on. So he has a huge bearing on the rhythm of the narrative right from the get-go. You know, every department has a pretty good blueprint of what's intended, at least, from the start.
The different genres of films, do they mean that your job means something different as editor?
Absolutely, yeah. I think every film I've done is a different job. There's an element of reinvention goes on with every new script because, you know, every story is different, every narrative, every actor, every performance and every director has a different way of doing things. So you can make the distinction. I've just completed a film called Suffragette, which was shot with that kind of realism, much more like a documentary in many respects, much more freeform, which, you know, is great for tension and for the action sequences, and, you know, it serves a different need within the story. I wouldn't say that one is any easier than the other, but they are very different in terms of the demands that get put on me as an editor.
Do you work from the script? I mean, obviously, that's presumably the first thing that comes through the letterbox, Barney, is the script itself. Are you, as an editor, scratching ahead and sort of punching the wall when stuff comes through and it doesn't really follow the script and you've kind of got an idea in your head of what you were going to do with it and you have to almost work from scratch on something?
Not really punching the wall at all, no.
I'm not suggesting you're of a violent temperament. I was just, that was a metaphor only.
There was me thinking you knew me quite well. No. You know, the script's serves as a great backbone, and it also serves as your initial contact with the piece and your initial reaction to the piece, and it does govern the decision as to whether to take the piece in many respects. You can feel the soul and the emotion at that stage, but, you know, I think on most films, maybe not the Grand Budapest so much because of how tightly wound the script was and how little it changed throughout the process, but largely with other scripts, you know, happy accidents occur on set. This is a collaborative art. it really doesn't bother me at all if things start to waver. You're just looking for truth, and if that means deviating either in the order of the script or indeed what the words actually are precisely that are said on set, then I welcome that.
Why do you want to be a lobby boy?
Who wouldn't? At the Grand Budapest, sir.
And so my life began. Junior lobby boy in training under the strict command of Monsieur Gustave H. Many of the hotel's most valued and distinguished guests came for him.
I love you.
I love you.
She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84.
I've had older.
This was also when I met Agatha.
She's charming. She's so charming.
Is he flirting with you?
Yes.
I approve of this union.
I became his pupil, and he was to be my counselor and guardian.
The police are here.
Tell them I'll be right down.
And I guess the essence of all great drama, other than the script, the performances, I mean, timing is everything. This, we think this is obviously something that the performers, that the actors have on the set, and that the director gets them into the right mood and points his camera in the right place. But how much of timing is done in the editing process? And I'm happy to hear the answer 100% from you, Barney.
An awful lot. Yeah, I mean, if the director doesn't get the mood right and doesn't get the timing how he wants it on the set and doesn't point the camera in the direction that it should be, you know, if that all of those elements aren't, as you know, singing beautifully when they come into the edit suite, then it gives us a much lesser chance of ending up with an individual scene or a joke or even a whole film that actually reads well. But a huge amount, not to make people think that the actors don't contribute huge amounts, but an awful lot of the timing is governed in the edit. I mean, obviously, well, we work in 24ths of a second, and there's a reason for that. You know, 24 frames every second, and we can choose any one of those 24 frames within that second to make an edit or to extend a look or a pause before a joke. You know, all of those things are wrought over indefinitely over a period of 20 weeks sometimes on a feature film. That's our main achievement, really, as well as performance. But, of course, performance itself is governed by rhythm and timing.
It's a strange thing. I mean, you mentioned you're working in such small amounts of time, these single frames. Is it strange to see it in its complete form when it comes back, when you're sitting in the audience on Oscars night, seeing your work up on the big screen again? Can you remember all the painstaking nights of teeth-grinding lunacy that you've put into this movie, or can you just enjoy it as a film?
I can kind of enjoy it, certainly The Grand Budapest, because it's... You know, aside from the work that we did in the edit suite, there is so much, such a wealth of high-end performance from all the other departments. You know, the costume design from Milena Cananero, the photography, Bobby Oman, Adam Stockhausen's production design. It really is a chocolate box of delights in terms of artistic filmic achievement. Of course, I can never unknow the things I've known. And, you know, as the months and years go by, you forget the painstaking elements of it and it becomes easy to digest. But I just feel immense pride and joy when I see it. And if I get sick of, you know, scrutinising, oh, did we get that edit right? Then I can just look at all the other wonderful things that are in any frame on Wes Anderson's films and take great pleasure from just watching those.
Don't you want Barney to win an Oscar more than anyone in the world? I do. Now, the Grand Budapest Hotel has been rightly lauded for its amazing sets. Cake shops, the interiors of grand locomotive carriages, spooky alpine towns, snowy dioramas, and of course, the titular gaff itself, with its bars, its bedrooms, its balconies, ballrooms, the works. Everyone wants to stay at the Grand Budapest Hotel. Anna Pinnock is nominated for Production Design Oscar on that film and also on Disney's Into the Woods, but we're going to keep it Grand Budapest for now. Here's Anna speaking to us from the set of her next big project, the new James Bond film, Spectre.
The designer, Adam Stockhausen and Wes, they had done a lot of recces of ancient and interesting hotels that are still in existence around Europe, and they'd also done a lot of research in, I think, Library of Congress they used a lot to get material. So I came on, I think, about 12 weeks out when I think they'd more or less settled on using the department store, the sort of extinct department store in Görlitz.
In terms of the materials that get sort of pushed across the production office table, we think this colour, you think that colour, we think this sort of, this these fabrics, this kind of whole atmosphere and vibe is so important, so vital and crucial to setting the atmosphere of the film. How does that work?
Yeah, so obviously Wes has got a very specific aesthetic, which, you know, we're all familiar with. There is a sort of look to his films, which I was familiar with. He does get very involved in the colour palette, but we have meetings and we, you know, put forward ideas, and then suddenly you're sort of launched and you're working in the aesthetic of the director, which is very much the case with working with Sam Mendes. You know, they have a certain aesthetic. And also the designer's aesthetics are equally important. And you just sort of start working, channeling yourself in that world.
We talked about Grand Budapest Hotel. I mean, that's got such a clear aesthetic, and it is very obviously aesthetic film, you know, set in a sort of fictional past, possibly, and all these things. How does that compare with working on, say, a Bond film, where you almost don't notice the set design and the set decoration? If you'll excuse me for not noticing it, but presumably that's the point, isn't it? It just seems real, or it seems hyper-real.
Yeah, I think that's the point. I think, you know, we were very much working in a fantasy world on Grand Budapest, but that being said, there's a lot of period accuracy, and there's a sort of homage to the two periods, and I think you really need to get your historical accuracy very correctly in your mind before you can depart from that and start adding the twist and the fantastical, which I think is what Wes does so brilliantly.
While you're on set, I mean, obviously, I presume there's a huge amount of planning, as we said, in getting the sort of materials, the sort of atmosphere and look that you're wanting, getting that right. In terms of practicality on the set day to day, what is the life of a set designer and set decorator?
Well, we obviously like to have the sets ready at least a couple of days or a day before. And we come in, you know, after the construction, have finished the set build. We like to be working several weeks in front of each set, but obviously we had an awful lot of small tableau sets on that film, and so we were literally running from one to another. So I did gather up a massive kit of parts, and we had an enormous storeroom actually in the basement of the department store where we kept absolutely everything, so that we were able to sort of run down and draw things out very quickly.
You mentioned Wes Anderson going out on lots of trips, lots of presumably horrible trips to lots of smart European hotels to do his research. What do you do? Are you
well,
at markets?
Or
you?
No, I'm normally in dank cellars and basements and barns around Saxony. And I mean, we went all over the place. We went to hire companies in Vienna, a lot of hire companies in London. We bought stuff locally. We used the old prop houses and the TV company and at the studios in Berlin, which have some amazing DDR stuff. And we found, actually, in a town called Chemnitz, an incredible collection of old DDR furniture, which was an incredible find, you know, in great volumes. So, you know, you have a lot of luck very often as a set decorator, and it's like a jigsaw piecing it all together.
That was Anna Pinnock, whose work as set decorator for the Grand Budapest Hotel has been nominated for an Oscar. Tune into the awards this Sunday to see who'll be taking home the prizes. After break, we'll nip over to Portland to visit a revitalised performing arts centre. It's more interesting than it sounds. It's hoping to counteract the closing of the city's music venues.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Locals in Portland, Oregon are calling it Barmageddon, the closing of legendary bars and music venues due to the city's rapid gentrification. Luckily, there's a new kid on the block, or old kid with a new attitude. Revolution Hall is a renovated performing arts centre housed within the historic and previously vacant George Washington High School in Portland's southeast neighbourhood. This weekend, Revolution Hall kicked off its first public events with concerts and two live tapings of radio shows that featured comedy performance and scintillating interviews. While its bar spaces are still under construction, reporter Melanie Sevchenko got a first glimpse of how an old relic will become a new standard in the changing tides of Portland's venue scene.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Revolution Hall.
February 12th kicked off the preview weekend of Revolution Hall, Portland's newest and only performing arts center of its kind in the city. The first band to take the stage to a sold-out crowd was local synth-pop act, Wild Ones. Housed in the former George Washington High School, built in 1906, Revolution Hall retains the classic characteristics of school life. Original lockers line the walls, broad staircases lead to massive glass double doors, and even staff members roam the halls wearing Hall Monitor t-shirts. Pre-show, patrons form a winding, bustling queue down the halls. Everyone is waiting for the first glimpse of a new institution in Portland's music community.
Trying to buy a ticket, tonight's show is totally sold out.
Revolution Hall is a labor of love between the owners of two existing venues in Portland, Mississippi Studios and the Aladdin Theater. Here's Kevin Craddock of Mississippi Studios.
So my business partner, Jim Brunberg, who founded Mississippi Studios, has always wanted us to not expand for the sake of expansion, but he really felt that this city needed a really high-quality, medium-sized room, and presently, until tonight, it does not have one.
When the high school was shut down in 1981, the historic building remained primarily vacant for decades. In 2013, it was bought from the city by developers. The 113,500-square-foot building was then renovated to accommodate offices, along with a stunning rooftop deck for private events. In fact, some of the construction crew who worked on the renovation are actually alumni of the high school. Kevin Craddock and his colleagues were brought in to reinvent the auditorium and repurpose it as an 830-seat performing arts venue, along with creating two new bars that will offer an extensive selection of beers from microbreweries across Oregon.
We kind of have this aesthetic that we like to call bar agnostic, where everyone feels welcome and comfortable depending on the programming of the room. And so it's all about the music, and it starts from there. The investment in the sound system and the team that's going to run it surpasses anything like it in town. Acoustically, you know, it's a 1924 fully renovated auditorium. The architecture of the building, I know this is radio, speaks for itself. You should see this building in daylight. The place it sits in the topography of southeast Portland with the panoramic views of downtown Portland, this building would have been torn down. So there's an added appreciation for the building itself beyond just wanting to open up a new music venue.
During the past decades, Portland has become a mecca for indie rock, and gave rise to musicians such as the Decemberists, the Dandy Warhols, M. Ward, and the late Elliott Smith. Other acts have transplanted to Oregon's largest city, like Modest Mouse and the Shins. But while there's never been a lack of venues in Portland, in recent years, the city has been experiencing a Barmageddon, meaning many of its beloved venues have closed due to rising property values in gentrified neighborhoods. Revolution Hall, in a sense, has a unique opportunity to fill that gap. For Kevin Craddock, that means staying true to the scene that put Portland on the map.
I don't like seeing neighborhoods change so quickly and so, you know, we're not here to change the neighborhood. We're here to put something in a building that makes sense for the Portland music community and the Portland performing arts community. I think this is going to be great for the neighborhood pubs, because everyone that I've talked to is excited, as far as business owners around here are excited, to bring a bigger and a wider audience to this neighborhood.
Andy Schrierer, guitarist and vocalist of Alleluia Choir, who headlined the preview weekend, is in full support of venues of all shapes and sizes. He says Revolution Hall is not trying to compete with or muscle out smaller music clubs.
They're not trying to do the same thing. We need all of those spaces. Those small rooms that you can get your foot in the door are the incubators for creativity and risk-taking that helps you form into what you're going to become as an artist. And a space like this in the middle opens doors. So here's another step in the rung that's like a musician-forward place. This space is being built by people that legitimately care the most about the music, the musicians, and the people listening over everything else. And I think it's going to be a great space. First impression is, I literally can't believe how well it's come together in such a short period of time. And it will get better for months and months before it really probably strikes its full stride. But I think tonight we're already in for something special.
Following a triumphant first night, Friday welcomed Seattle-based author, sex advice columnist, and podcaster Dan Savage to record a live taping of his show, Savage Lovecast, promoted as a pre-Valentine's Day pity party. And Saturday showcased the season opener of Portland's Livewire. A radio variety show that features music, comedy, performance, and interviews with artists and writers. Livewire airs on public radio stations across America. Revolution Hall will have its official opening in April. For Monocle in Portland, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
Thanks, Melanie. Coming up in the second half of the show, more raspy Americana from Ryan Bingham, and I'll head down to an exhibition at London's Barbican that turns artists into collectors. Plus, in Toronto, we meet a group of friends who've turned their play into an unlikely hit. That's all here on Culture, with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Ryan Bingham is in the studio for us this week, playing us a few tracks from his latest record, Fear and Saturday Night. In a moment, he'll shoot the breeze with Monocle's Paul Noble. But first, here he is, performing radio.
Well, hey, baby, won't you come and kiss me? I need your love tonight. And wrap your arms all the way around me. Tell me I'm all right. Well, I know the hardest part living is letting go. But bad dreams or sad memories keep a playing on my radio. My radio makes me wanna just lose my head. My radio just lose my head. In your car, driving on a freeway, you put your hand in mine. My radio is static in my cocaine, I never close my eyes. Well, I've always heard that you dream beyond your doubts. I hesitate, but I know my transceiver is living in the here and now. My radio makes me wanna just lose my head. My radio my head. me out to the middle of somewhere so I can hear the moonlight. My radio is breaking up and I fear I got the wires crossed inside. And I know I feel this way 'cause I keep it to myself. Well, I can't go on this way, honey, baby, I need some help. My radio makes me wanna just lose my head. My radio makes me wanna just lose my head. Come and kiss me, I need your love tonight. And wrap your arms all the way around me, tell me I'm alright. Well, I know the hardest part of living is letting go. The bad dreams, the sad memories keep a playing on my radio.
Ryan Bingham, thank you very much for that lovely session. First of all, we have to talk about your fantastic guitar style. It was a very delicate finger picking. What was your first sort of memories of playing guitar or your first influences when you started out?
Well, the first thing I ever learned how to play was an old classical kind of Spanish song called the La Malagueña. I had moved down to Laredo, Texas. It was on the border of Texas and Mexico. And there was a guy that just lived next door to me that would play these old songs on his porch in the afternoons. And he was the first guy to teach me how to play a song on the guitar. And what I thought about that song was just it kind of had all those different styles of finger picking, and there was some strumming parts to it. And it was just a couple of different, you know, techniques, playing techniques all in that one song. So it was kind of a nice first song to learn. Yeah.
So let's talk about Fear and Saturday Night. It's been kind of a sea change for you since the last album with your band and your sort of production methods. Tell us a bit about what's been going on with the production of this album.
You know, this album, I just really wanted to get back to the songwriting and kind of the roots of the songs. I wanted the songs to stand alone just if I was playing them with an acoustic guitar, you know, and solo. I didn't really want to have to depend on kind of the band and the production of the record and that to, you know, try to recreate that all the time. Definitely a lot has kind of just gone on in my life over the past 5 or 6 years, just personally and with the musically. And it's kind of just a fresh start at things. I spent quite a bit of time just sitting with the songs and really trying to, you know, make sure that I was writing stuff that I really wanted to say and get out and perform live. So I'm really excited about it.
We have to talk a bit about Crazy Heart as well, which you worked. It was the fantastic film from 2009 with Jeff Bridges. And you worked with T-Bone Burnett on that, who is not just in the film world, but in the music world. He's a, you know, he's a legend, and he's someone who really digs deep into the music of the past and brings it back to life and puts it on all these films, which he seems to be music supervisor on. How was that whole process and then the sort of subsequent sort of hype and excitement that came after that?
You know, it was a hell of an experience. It was a very surreal experience for me, you know, going from just playing in a bar band, touring around the States in a van, and, you know, all of a sudden I'm in the studio with guys like T-Bone and Stephen Bruton and all the guys that were playing on that record. But it all happened so fast. It really kind of, it was hard. It was really not till after the fact when you could step away from it and kind of realize what had happened and what all went down. But it was such an incredible experience and something that I'll definitely hope to tell the grandkids about one day. You know.
And how did he sort of find you and reach out to you? Did he hear about you playing live, or was it a CD?
A CD. I think it was one of my couple of first records that I put out. And originally the director of the film got in touch with me. I just went and had lunch with him, and he gave me a copy of the script and said they were looking for some people to contribute some songs and to write. And he said to give him a call if I, you know, if anything came up. And I remember taking the script on the road for a couple of weeks and reading it and started working on the song and called him up. And I said, hey, I got this song. I want, you know, maybe I should send it to you in the mail. And he said, well, if you're in Los Angeles, just, we're at T-Bone Burnett's house right now. Why don't you just bring it over here to us?
I'm picturing a porch and some rocking chairs.
Yeah, well, it was kind of, I walked up to the door and knocked on the door, and T-Bone answered the door, and he's, you know, he's almost 7 foot tall. He's a very tall, large man, and I figured I would just drop the record off and be about my way, but he said, no, why don't you come inside? And I walked in, and Jeff Bridges was there, and Stephen Bruton, and about 20 people, all these music supervisors and the director, and he took I had a copy of the song on a CD, and I just roughly recorded it at home, and he just went and put it straight on the stereo and played it through the whole house in front of everybody.
While no pressure.
Yeah. And he said, that sounds pretty good. He goes, can you play it for us live on the couch right here? And he grabbed a guitar, and I said, yeah, I'll play it for you. And I played the song, and he looked around. He said, that's it. That's going to be the one. So, and that was it. From then on, I kind of hung out for about a month and kept writing and recording with them.
That was Ryan Bingham speaking to Monocle's Paul Noble. The record Fear and Saturday Night is out now, and he's playing dates across the US over the next couple of months. Google it. As previous weeks on this show will attest, there are a wealth of amazingly good exhibitions on in London at the moment. And we have a new addition in the form of Magnificent Obsessions at the Barbican, whose subtitle, The Artist as Collector, explains all. Damien Hirst and his skulls and taxidermy, Peter Blake and his endless collections of elephant figurines, Andy Warhol and his comfortingly folksy porcelain cookie jars, and many, many more. So what does What Artists Collect tell us about them, their taste, and how and why they make the work they do? In front of Jim Shaw's collection of paintings bought from American junk shops, I spoke to the show's curator, Lydia Yee.
I think artists have been collecting for centuries for different reasons, as source material, as reference material, as props for paintings. Maybe that's not so much the basic reason why artists collect today, but I think there's always a connection to the work. For example, an artist might be collecting thrift store paintings, and somehow that aesthetic of the kind of very naive, strange, bizarre imagery bleeds over into the work. So Jim Shaw has been collecting this kind of material for the better part of 20 years or so, and his own paintings have the same kind of imagery, but I mean, they're not as naive, but the subject matter in some ways is drawing on this kind of what he considers like the underbelly of America. So he thinks of trawling the thrift shops as sort of like an archaeology of the unconscious of America.
I wonder what you think about the idea of the honesty of a collection as opposed to some of the work that people make. You can't help liking the stuff that maybe you hang in your house or you keep under your bed or you keep in the attic. But I wonder whether there's a straight line or whether there's a wiggly line or any sort of line at all between the honesty and the naivety of some of these collections and the work that bears the artist's name.
Well, I think there is something honest and basic about a lot of the objects, but I also think artists, there is certainly the connoisseur artist as well, who in some ways, in a very strategic way, is going after very particular objects. So while some of the artists might be going to flea markets or thrift shops, others are going to the auction houses and buying from dealers. So, you know, I think it goes both ways and shows you the range of artistic interests, from the very kind of mass popular culture to the high end, to the beautiful object, to the singular Indian Mughal painting.
And I wanted to ask you about the way that these collections have been displayed here, and how much you know of where they sit in their owners' storage facilities or the homes themselves, how true you had to be, or whether you're interested in that at all.
Well, that was definitely something that I was interested in. I didn't want this to be a clinical museum-like show. We didn't have the desire to put things into white showcases and make everything look the same. That would have been incredibly boring. I worked very closely with the architect, Stivik Kalin. We took a lot of cues from the ways in which artists live with and display their objects. So if their studios are messy and full of things all over the walls, we tried to replicate that. And if it's very precise and simple and clean, we also did that. We've made selections of display cabinets and different furnishings, and even put things like rugs into the rooms to give it more of a kind of domestic environment. Hopefully people won't feel like they're walking into a conventional gallery space, a white cube.
In terms of choosing the collections and the artists that you've put in the show. Did you know presumably you knew the work of the artist first and then wondered what their collections might be like, or did you just know that these people had fantastic collections? Some artists sort of defy their work in the way that their collections are so multifarious and messy and strange.
In some cases, I had a pretty good idea that the artist was already a collector. I mean, you can pick it up perhaps from their work. In a few examples, I had already seen collection exhibitions like Hiroshi Sugimoto's exhibition at the Japan Society in 2005. But in other cases, it was a bit of a guess, or I asked around, or, you know, you might have an idea of, you know, if they're drawing from many, many different sources and interested in a broad range of things, that they're probably more likely to have a collection than if their work is very singular and focused on only one topic.
I just wonder whether you thought some of these collections in the way, not necessarily in the way that you've shown them here, but in the way that they are kept sort of normally, as you might say, whether they are accidental works of art in themselves, whether their sort of collision of sensibilities make them obviously more than the sum of their parts.
Certainly, I think that's the case. I mean, if you just see a pile of records on a floor somewhere, it doesn't seem like a work of art. But when you arrange them and you see the kind of motifs that an artist is interested in because of the imagery on the record covers, for example, as with Dr. Lacra, you get a sense that it is becoming kind of like a work of art. And there are a number of objects in the exhibition that sort of have a in-between status between collectible item and work of art. Dr. Lacra is another example. He has a series of scrapbooks, some of which are still scrapbooks, but others he's written on and mounted onto drawers or trays, and they have a different status than the scrapbook that he just keeps wrapped up in storage.
We talked about the idea of Wunderkammer right at the beginning. I wondered whether that's that idea writ large. It's a collection of things from the artist that you like yourself.
Very much so. The space here is organized almost like a cabinet of curiosities already. It's a big box with lots of little boxes that compose the larger whole. So already when I started thinking about whether or not this exhibition made sense for the Barbican, the space just lent itself to that and almost organized itself in terms of where things would go and the spatial arrangements.
Yeah, because you have to be careful with, I suppose, spacing things out. Having these, we're in Jim Shaw's room at the moment, these, as you said, naive paintings, the underbelly of American taste, maybe, next to these sort of stately lions and stuff. I suppose curating this and putting one space next to another is pretty vital in these sort of, as you say, little cubby holes.
Well, one of the great things about the Barbican is that we always get to work with architects. It's a complicated space and we need help sorting it out. So we often bring on young architects to look at the space, analyze how it might work, and bring their ideas to bear on it.
That was Lydia Yee showing me around Magnificent Obsessions, the artist as collector at the Barbican here in London. And that show is on until the 25th of May, and it's brilliant. After the break, we're going to the theatre in Toronto. Stay tuned.
As Design Miami celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, Monocle Films explored new themes in the collectible design market.
I think that we're beginning to become more of a design-driven culture as we learn to consume more responsibly. We're beginning to learn that better design helps us actually live better. And I think America's finally waking up to that fact.
Pull up a chair to watch Design Miami 2014, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. It's an unlikely revival of an unlikely play. For a decade, Sheila Hetty's All Our Happy Days Are Stupid was thought unproducible, too challenging and perhaps too odd to ever mount. It's a critique of the pursuit of happiness, by the way. But following the surprising success of a 2013 production put on by a group of Hetty's friends, many of them non-actors, All Our Happy Days is moving to an even bigger stage. On Saturday, it completed another well-received run at Toronto's World Stage Festival, and this week it arrives at New York's The Kitchen Theatre. Monocle correspondent Chris Frey dropped by rehearsals in Toronto to find out how the DIY production is scaling up.
I think this is the best day of my life.
Oh,
always know when I'm having one of the best days of my life. I get this little feeling deep down inside
of me. All right, we've heard enough.
The more you talk about it, the less true it will be.
Oh, I don't find that at all. I find the more I talk about it, the more true it'll be. Talking about it makes it true.
Just watch the parade.
It's this box of stories, and it lives in a farce. The way that we've put it on, and the way that it's been written.
That's Aaron Brubaker, co-director of All Our Happy Days Are Stupid, a play that once seemed destined never to reach the stage.
It's full of melodrama and heightened, you know, ridiculousness in some ways, but it's also very poignant and true.
Over a decade in development, the play, written by Sheila Hetty, with music by Dan Behar of the band Destroyer, had earned a reputation for being unproducible. Various theater companies tried workshopping it, only to be confounded by the script's odd alchemy of absurdism and melodrama. And so it went, until the 2010 publication of Hetty's novel, How Should a Person Be?, which in part describes the writer's struggles to finish the impossible play she's working on. The novel had struck a chord with Jordan Tannehill, of the Toronto theater company Suburban Beast, so he asked Hetty if he could have a look at the play. It was then, during a backyard reading of the script among friends, many of whom weren't actors, that Hetty says All Our Happy Days finally came to life.
It was the first time that I'd ever heard the script work. Like, it was just funny, and everyone had a good time. And in all the previous incarnations, all the other workshop productions, the actors had so much difficulty with the script, like, why would my character do this? And all these resistances. And nobody had any resistance to the script. They were just campy and serious and, you know, funny. And I don't know, I think the fact that everyone had such a good time made the script exciting to me in a new way.
That backyard reading would soon lead to the play's sold-out, much-talked-about debut in fall 2013 at a small alternative performance space in Toronto called Video Fag. Carl Wilson was among the non-actors conscripted to perform, playing the Prince for All Seasons. His day job is music critic for Slate.com.
The initial production came together almost sort of out of thin air. Crew of people, we all knew each other in one way or another, and then within like what felt like a rapid few weeks, pulled this production together. We were very unsure of what we had, and it just kind of burst into life. And the stage was full of prop pieces hanging from nails on the wall, and there was just a thin white strip of stage, and then a foot in front of us was the audience. You could literally touch them, and sometimes accidentally did. It was a really odd kind of picture frame for a play to be in, and it produced this kind of intense pressure and intense intimacy and familiarity from the moment the play begins. There's kind of a sense of shock in the audience that there's this, like, it's almost as if a plane is just rushing at you, full of weird circus performers and odd royalty and strange Canadians.
I think we all knew that it was a very strange, unconventional play that meandered and sometimes didn't make sense.
Naomi Squarna is a writer. She plays Miss Odie, one of the leads.
We just decided to highlight all of the awkwardness and all of the artificiality, which somehow went along with the fact that half of us aren't actors.
This odd duck of a play had suddenly found its feet, and its reputation only grew after the fact. Then came invitations to revive the play for Toronto's World Stage Festival, and, starting this week, at The Kitchen in New York, the original cast reprising their roles. But how would the play come across on a much larger stage, and a more conventional theater space? Would its intimacy and energy translate?
We set up this space that's like a storybook.
Co-director Aaron Brubaker.
Where characters are pulled out of the wings and employed in a set of fit for paper dolls, you know. We're not going for realism at all here. You know, it's the set is completely, you know, two-dimensional, and the props are two-dimensional. You know, coffee cups are drawn on white foam core with black marker and held in a two-dimensional fashion. And a lot of the movements of the actors are in a kind of planar world, which is just to sort of say, it's kind of sets the tone and the rules for the audience. So we can all just agree that we don't have to, not everything has to be plausible.
Back at the recital, signs remain vital. The statue of stone that rejects its own pulse. Your heart's fair, your heart's fair, your heart's not even there. Wasting surely on the girl from Point Saint.
In the Video Fag production in 2013, I think we were just also excited to put it on, that it being a play never even really occurred to me. It was more like a happening or an event or, you know, a celebration, let's say. But the actual production that I saw last night, I saw it as a script, you know, and I always loved reading plays. And my first favorite writers were playwrights like, you know, Pinter and Beckett and Ionesco. And it was just, it felt like for the first time that I had actually written a play. And I was sort of moved to see the production last night. I could see it not just in this iteration, but other iterations. Whereas the Video Fag thing, I was just like, this will never happen again. It can never happen again.
I think it's an amazing piece of theater because it is so unresolved.
Naomi Squarna.
Because it's so dreamlike, and because it introduces characters and then just does away with them, it's irreverent to theatrical form, which I think theater needs, contemporary theater really, really needs. People really connect with Sheila's writing and Sheila's vision of the world, and maybe more than any of her other writing, this play kind of provides access into her wild imagination.
For Monocle, in Toronto, I'm Chris Frey. Thanks, Chris. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher. Talk about a magnificent obsession. Time for one final song from this week's Midori House session. Here's Ryan Bingham again with The Snow Falls in June. Thanks for tuning in.
Snow is falling in June. The leaves, no excuses for summer, and your sky fades from blue. It steals your light of day, and share with me your wounds, and open up your window to wonder. There's a helpless tune that I could help you sing. And if you ever call my name, I'll come a run. If your sorrow sings in pain, I'll be there. If you ever feel a change in your weather, take shelter with me here, my dear. If the snow is falling in June, if ever you lose whatever turns your tears into laughter, and your bridge is broken in two, and your love's lost the way, just hand me over your blues and break away the bad from your burden, settle into your shoes. Let me tie your strings, and if you ever call my name, I'll come a run. If your sorrow sings in pain, I'll be there. If you ever feel a change in your weather, take shelter with me here, my dear. If your snow is falling in June, mm-hmm. My love for you is true. Without you I'm a shipwreck abandoned. You're my lady in the moon. My blanket made of stars. And if you ever call my name, I'll come a run. If your sorrow sings in pain, I'll be there. And if you ever feel a change in your weather, take shelter with me here, my dear. If your snow is falling in June,